Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Hey, so we have a third co-host tonight who we haven't had on before, C Money Burns. You want to go ahead and introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yeah, I'm C Money Burns from Portland, Maine. I primarily produce mix and master music for other artists in the indie hip hop experimental electronic vein from my home studio called Cosmic Black. I'm a touring multi-instrumentalist with releases under my own name, C Money Burns. So I just put out a cassette and a book project called The Subjugation of Bread with my main collaborator, Rhode Island rapper, visual artist, writer, and road dog for life, Rosowski. The music is what we like to call haunted Marxist art rap. It's a $23 plus post at brzowskimusic.bandcamp.com. That's BRZOWSKI music. And you can find me on Twitter at CMoneyBurns.
Wow, that's dope.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah.
So we have Ross Barkin, who is an award-winning journalist, writes for Jacobin and The Guardian, as well as a lot of other publications. But he's going to talk about where we sit in the left today in the U.S. and what are we to do during a Biden presidency. So he's got a lot of great stuff for us to kind of take apart after the interview. But before we even get started with kind of our news roundup, C Money, you were just telling us about some of the big wins that DSA has made in your home city of Portland, Maine. If you could kind of share some of those with our listeners, they sound like a really big deal.
Yeah, I was mentioning that we've had some big wins, and I've been a little surprised, sad to not see more left media outlets picking up on this stuff, because it's kind of huge. You know, our local DSA chapter, we have one for Southern Maine, promoted three different referendums in the city, and these are just within Portland for now, but I think it kind of bodes well for what's going on in our state overall. We were able to pass rent control, which is huge. We were able to pass a local Green New Deal, and we were able to pass a $15 an hour minimum wage plus hazard pay for COVID. And there has been naturally some opposition to it, but all three referendums passed by a wide majority in the city. We had rent control up actually two times previously in the past 5 years, and it failed both times with a strong effort from Southern Maine Landlords Association. And this time they still put a ton of money behind it, but I think the COVID really kind of changed people's perspective on that sort of thing. Eviction moratoriums, stuff like that. And, you know, a lot of the local businesses have been proactive with the $15 an hour and the hazard pay. It wasn't set to be implemented until 2022, but a lot of them are doing it right now just to kind of get used to it and to step up their game. There is a lawsuit right now between, I think it's Southern Maine Chamber of Commerce or Portland Chamber of Commerce in the city, but there's some analysis out there already that says it's dead in the water because the legislation is airtight. And I think that's a huge win for the local DSA. I think it's a huge win for DSA nationally to even get a foot in the door in a place like Portland. I mean, I think if it can happen here, it can happen anywhere.
No, that is so hopeful. That those are huge wins, and it shows that what can happen when organizers, you know, really take hold at the local level and embrace that local change.
Burns, it reminds me of, I'm from Burlington, Vermont, and originally, and when the Burn came to town, they just thought it was a guy who couldn't afford a hairbrush and was wearing his grandfather's inherited cardigan. But it turns out the guy had some ideas. So you guys, yeah. It's a very reminiscent city. I've been to Portland many times. It's very reminiscent of Burlington, you know, minus the ocean part.
Well, you guys have the lake up there. And, you know, Burlington is the only other place in the United States I've seen communist graffiti in a bathroom. So I love Burlington.
You're very observant while in bathrooms. I tend to just grind it out, you know?
You see, like, little sketched Lenin heads and Bookchin quotes on a bathroom wall. I mean, bound to look.
Yeah, yep. That's going to catch your eye, especially if you've been reading your theory. So let's start off by talking about where we stand nationally with the fight for 15. I think a lot of people were hopeful that it would be included in Biden's $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, but it looks like a parliamentarian has stepped on that.
Yeah. My personal view on it is that I was really hoping it would pass. You know, I'm self-employed myself. I have a recording studio in my house, but most of my clients are independent musicians. A lot of musicians have service sector jobs, food service jobs that are minimum wage and
day work, they call it, right?
Yeah. But like since the pandemic and since those jobs have been restricted, I've lost a ton of business. I've had to go on food stamps myself. So I feel strongly about it. My wife works a minimum wage job as well, and it's been a lot harder to scrape by. So it's an issue that's personal to me.
From what I know, and I've only just started to learn about Senate parliamentarian procedures, but it seems like with the ACA, when Republicans were trying to get a ruling, the parliamentarian basically said, you can get rid of the penalty. It looks to me now that Bernie is working on a 5% payroll tax for big companies who don't pay a certain amount. So in other words, he's making it fiscal because the parliamentarian has ruled in the past that that's how she sort of leans. It's like, you have to jump through this fucking hoop. And if you jump high enough, you know, and I don't know if you know, Bernie was a track and field star back in his high school days. So he's happy to get a couple feet of air.
Well, there are two things that strike me about that. And one is that the parliamentarian's ruling is non-binding, so you can just disregard it. And the other piece of that is you can make a pretty strong argument for the fact that this is very budget related. You know, you raise everybody.
Hell yeah.
You raise the minimum wage across the country, and you're going to be collecting a lot more in tax revenue from payroll taxes.
Yeah, I felt disappointed that we didn't hear more commentary from the Democrats involved about the parliamentarian's decision. It was just kind of like it happened and they said, well, that's that, we're moving on, without like, hey, this is why we're going along with that, this is why we're not challenging it, you know. I think there's some obvious explanations, like, of course, if they went along with it anyways, they face lawsuits over it, they face parts of it getting suspended or rescinded. But I wish there was more public conversation about it. I feel like it was just kind of, they put it up, they got a little bit of pushback, and then just gave it up right away.
Well, yeah, and I think people will say that that's a little bit of the modus operandi of, you know, Democrats in the Senate in particular. But I think the one thing you have to question is which big corporations are getting involved in this process behind the scenes. So we saw this with the healthcare debate. You know, Obama went in thinking of something much stronger than what the ACA turned out to be. And then once you let those big pharma and big insurance companies help write the bill, you end up with something that looks a lot different. C-Money, you spent a little bit of time today, and I was kind of surprised to see it, but watching the CPAC presentation, what'd you think?
Oh, I'm a glutton for punishment, kind of, but I also just like taking a peek at these things, and even just from like a technical production point of view, and it was a total shit show from end to end. It was like one of the most hilarious things I've seen in a long time. Like it started out with this girl singing the national anthem, and she must have had like 11 and a half key changes in there. And it was just, it was atrocious, breathtaking.
And not in a good way.
You know, like Trump was supposed to come out at 3:30 and give his first big return speech since finally leaving D.C., and so, like, I tuned in at 3:30, you know, like an ass. And of course he wasn't out there. But the fun part was like all the backpedaling and wheel spinning that they were doing, just trying to bide time. Like they had all of these kind of package videos playing, like Matt Schlapp talking down to various journalists, talking to activists in Hong Kong, talking about cancel culture. I think their whole theme was like uncancel America or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Which is funny because they had to cancel like one of their speakers because he was a little on the anti-Semitic side, which was really funny. But they hemmed and hawed. There was a lot of dead air filling. They played that awful Lee Greenwood song, "The Proud to Be an American." They played that song at least 4 times, I counted.
Oh.
They had a cameraman outside, at least on like the RSBN network, that was like running around the building trying to find the Trump car coming in, and the cameraman was complaining about it on mic, like on the air. It was just like epic shit show.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And then Trump finally got there, and he came out onto the stage, and they started "Proud to Be an American" again, and they couldn't stop it. So he had to stand there for like 4 minutes waving and doing his pointing thing and thumbs up thing and the little jerk off motion that he does. And then finally he got to start the big speech, and he comes out with, "Did you miss me?" Oh, and then, you know, it was a catalog of the greatest hits, really, from there. It was kind of his populist love language stuff.
Sounds like if it hadn't been just like a comedy of errors and them falling apart left and right, you might have tuned out. Maybe during that second "Proud to Be an American."
Yeah, they seem to kind of even run out of filler stuff.
So, Patrick, you mentioned Ross Barkan. He's a columnist, right? And he's also an author, I understand?
Yep. So he's written a novel. He's written for a number of publications and won some awards in so doing. He covers the left a lot. So he's done a lot of coverage of AOC. But he's also got a nonfiction book coming out in the next few days, actually. He just announced it on Twitter, and he mentioned it at the very end of the interview. But he went and did an investigatory book about Cuomo, you know, governor of New York. And let me just say, it's not a laudatory book. It's not what Cuomo...
Cuomo's innocent. Save Cuomo.
Or what Cuomo spat out about himself to win himself that Emmy for his coronavirus coverage, which is just another crazy thing. But yeah, Barkan had a lot of really interesting things to say about where we are in the left right now, what we should do during a Biden's presidency, and kind of like some of the problems that are plaguing the Democratic Party. So I found it to be, you know, really informative. Our guest is Ross Barkan, an award-winning journalist and former candidate for office. He's a columnist for The Guardian and Jacobin, as well as a contributor to The Nation and Gothamist WNYC. He's written a novel called Demolition Night, and he's won the New York Press Club's Award for Distinguished Journalism twice. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Mr. Barkan. I'm excited to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here and talk about the present and future of the left and of politics in general.
So let's start with where we are right now in terms of who we have as president. Why does Biden spend so much time on the campaign trail? He was trashing the left or trying to draw separation between himself and people like Bernie Sanders. What does he stand to gain from doing that?
You know, it's an interesting question. He inherently is someone who is of the center and center left tradition in American politics. He was never a part of movement politics. It's very foreign to him. He's been a political weather vane for much of his life. So for him, he's never felt at home with the progressive movement broadly, and certainly if you look at his career in the Senate and then serving with Obama, he's someone who has supported the Iraq war, been in favor of deregulation, was an architect of the crime bill. This is who he is. I would say this incarnation of Biden is the most progressive Biden that we've seen, just in terms of the fact that he is considering a very large stimulus bill and advocating for sending money to people, and that he seems to have some interest in some large economic development programs. Of course, he's still quite hostile to many of the goals of the left, including universal healthcare, single-payer healthcare in particular, he has no interest in fulfilling. So, you know, some of it is just inherent in who he is and the type of politician he is. He's also someone who, like a lot of institutional figures, believes there will be a backlash if you tack too far in any one direction. I think that's a lesson that's ingrained in him. And he feels that since he won the primary and won the presidency, he can only go so far or face the wrath of Republicans. This has been a pathology, for lack of a better word, on the Democratic side for a long time, this fear of right-wing back. And I think what we've seen is no matter what you do, there is right-wing backlash. And I also want to sound a note of optimism that there's no doubt this is the most progressive incarnation of the mainstream Democratic Party we've seen in modern times, maybe not in the 1930s and 40s, but you know, this version, in terms of if its commitment to economic issues, it is more committed to furthering the cause of expanding government on behalf of working class and poor people than it has been in many decades. And certainly this Democratic Party does have a commitment to racial justice and civil rights in a way that it didn't always have in the past. So a lot of that is the work of activists, of people on the ground, and of these movements and currents that have been in the air for a while, and the work of people like Bernie Sanders. You know, there would not have been a $600 check if it weren't for Bernie Sanders standing up in the Senate and forcing the issue. And certainly the $1,400 check that may come is also the work of, in part, the work of Bernie, his advocacy. And, you know, Biden is someone who is reactive to current events and to movement politics. He didn't come out of it, but he is someone who can be pushed further than he would like to go. And I think it's incumbent on the left to keep pushing him and to not be too nihilistic about it, to not be too much in despair. There's still a lot that can be done, even with Joe Biden in the White House.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think the circles that I see on Twitter tend to be overreacting right now and saying, oh, look, there's no pushing him to the left. And I think you make a great point that there's still quite a bit of time and there's still quite a bit of pressure that can be applied. So it's no secret that the Democratic Party continues to try to shift focus away from progressive leaders like Bernie Sanders and AOC. You wrote in The Guardian shortly after the Democratic National Convention that the party's making a mistake to continue to hold up Bill Clinton as a hero of the party while at the same time giving short shrift to an energetic young leader like AOC, who's built up an impressive following among younger voters through her engagement on platforms like Twitter and Instagram. First, why do you think the Democratic Party continues to try to downplay the enthusiasm that voters have for AOC? And second, what are they risking in doing so?
It's a good question. I would say first that the political figure they feared the most and viewed as the most disruptive was Bernie Sanders. I think the 2020 Bernie Sanders campaign and the degree to which Democratic establishment forces rallied together to stop Bernie, you know, he was someone who's definitely viewed as a quite disruptive force who would really change how business was done and would really cast out of the garden the various Democratic apparatchiks who've been attached to the party for decades. I think, you know, since I wrote that piece, I do think the Democratic Party is moving further away from Bill Clinton. I'm very optimistic about that. You don't hear him invoked nearly as much. His approach to economics has really been discredited on the left, and it's actually been discredited on the right as well. You know, one of the fascinating trends now is that even the Republican Party, which is so revanchist and so horrendous in so many ways, you know, under Donald Trump, this is still a Republican Party that's willing to spend more government money than any other version of the Republican Party. And that is just a marker of the zeitgeist and just where we are, that Donald Trump himself was the architect of a bigger stimulus bill than Barack Obama. I mean that is kind of an absurd fact if you really think about it, but that's where we are. The Clintonite approach to economics has certainly been increasingly discarded. I think you know, Bill Clinton is still someone who's dragged out of the shadows. You know, his political corpse is brought to life at these sort of conventions among people who are, you know, very much who actually don't understand how the world works now. So I would say that caveat that I do see a shift there. In terms of AOC, you know, she's a very charismatic figure. She's someone with a very large following. She's someone who's very adept at communicating her issues. She's certainly a lightning rod as well. I think a lot of Democratic leaders still don't quite know what to do with her, in that she's not controlled. She's not someone you can guide one way or the other. And she has and she's built a following through social media that is independent of the party actors and what they can do. You know, we've never seen a moment in history where a congresswoman in her second term wields such a large platform and bully pulpit. You know, that is just not really heard of. You've seen presidents have it, maybe some popular senators, members of Congress who've been there a longer time, who maybe had some fame already, but what she has is unique. So a lot of Democratic Party figures are wary of that, and they know her agenda is her agenda, and there's only so much they can do to guide her one way or the other. You mentioned the Democratic National Convention back in the summer. It was quite poor overall. It really did not discuss serious economic issues at all. It did not feature people like Ocasio-Cortez, who should have been featured or given more time. And you saw in the outcome of the election, you know, Joe Biden won on the strength of this massive anti-Trump wave, which didn't surprise me one bit. What did surprise me, and in retrospect is less surprising, but still I expected the wave to do more for other Democrats, was that Republicans did quite well otherwise, that Donald Trump brought a lot of Republicans to the polls. They voted in great numbers, and they were able to defeat Democrats in Congress, in state legislatures. And the Biden campaign and the National Democratic Party apparatus was beaten soundly beyond the presidency. And they were able to save face in the Senate runoff, where you really had two very bad Republican incumbents and two pretty good Democratic candidates who are very disciplined in Warnock and Ossoff were able to win. So it was very much a mixed bag for Democrats on election night.
In an article published in Jacobin on the 9th of December last year, you asked whether or not the American media would go back to brunch with Biden now in the White House. Love the framing of that question. But in it, you also pointed out that coverage of Trump and kind of moving on, quitting that coverage, would be really difficult for these same news organizations. The latter question has been somewhat resolved by Twitter's decision to ban Trump and the unexpected silence we've had on that end. But the former question of how Biden would be covered in American media outlets remains. What do you think so far? Has the media gone back to brunch, or are they still continuing to do their jobs?
It's certainly a mix. You've had strong reporting on the Biden administration, on his cabinet pick, on his policy priorities. At the same time, you don't see the same level of aggression, the same level of the feeling of being an adversary. You certainly don't see that. You also saw a lot of gauzy, over-the-top coverage of the Biden-Harris inauguration, of very flowery language there's an instance of where the Washington Post edited a Kamala Harris story to make it more favorable to her. These certainly mainstream cable TV outlets and mainstream newspapers have not been as adversarial as they were when they covered Donald Trump. And some of that is for obvious reasons. Donald Trump was a uniquely horrendous figure. He certainly needed to be covered as such. But that also doesn't mean your posture of accountability changes when a Democrat comes into the White House. So the jury is still out on that. You know, we're 1 month into Biden's tenure, but I would certainly like to see a more skeptical press and see a press that takes its watchdog role seriously, because, you know, government is enormously powerful and consequential, and the weaponry, the influence, the sheer size of it all it needs accountability and sunlight. And many of the problems that we're facing this country before Donald Trump are facing our country now. And Trump, in some ways, radically changed politics and was a disruptive figure. In other ways, he wasn't at all. The national security state was largely unchanged, you know, aesthetically maybe in Trump's fights with the FBI and the CIA, but in terms of the substance, nothing changed about the national security state.
And draining the swamp never really happened.
You know? No, not at all. The way America wages war, we didn't close military bases. The military industrial complex was undisturbed. And it's been undisturbed now since George W. Bush. From Bush to Obama to Trump to Biden, that's four presidents. We've had a Department of Homeland Security, which did not exist before George W. Bush. We have had a Patriot Act. We've had a spy apparatus. We have had massive military buildups. This stuff has survived Republican and Democratic administrations. And so I hope the media can pay close attention to really the machinery of government and to what is really done, and emphasize that far more than politics and aesthetics. And a lot of Trump boiled down to ugly words and aesthetics. There was bad policy, don't get me wrong, particularly on the environment, on immigration. But Donald Trump did not invent immigrations and custom enforcement. ICE was also a 21st century creation. And this was often lost in the narrative as Trump was painted as a fascist, as someone who was so uniquely disruptive to the American project. The tools he was using, these tools of so-called fascism, were tools that were built by other presidents. And he was aiming weapons at vulnerable people that were given to him by prior administrations. And very few people were questioning, well, why are these weapons there? Why are these institutions here? Why do they exist? You know, there was a brief abolish ICE movement that faded. You remember that?
Yeah.
There has not really been an abolish a Department of Homeland Security movement. There has been an abolish and defund the police movement, but that's ultimately a local issue that has nothing to do with what the president does or doesn't do. So these are some issues, you know, I would like to see the press focus on more.
So you've correctly pointed out that the left has been losing working class, you know, to borrow words from Trump, uneducated voters. But these voters are still important. They're vital, really. Why are these voters voters without college degrees, leaving the Democratic Party? And what do you think needs to be done in order to win them back?
Why they're leaving is a question that is hotly debated. I've read studies where it's not just an American trend, but a global trend too, that left of center parties have been losing working class voters now for decades. Some of it certainly is policy. You've seen a Democratic Party over the last few decades reorient itself away from organized labor, away from the black and white working classes, that has pursued a neoliberal agenda that favors big business and free trade and reduced regulations on businesses at the expense of American workers. I do believe the decline of labor unions has played a real role in the loss of working class voters in the Democratic coalition. Even if a voter 30 years ago was culturally conservative on various social issues, that voter would still be in the Democratic Party because he or she understood that they belong to a labor union and this labor union's rights were protected by the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party was the party of organized labor. So you've seen the Republicans very wisely and maliciously both attack labor unions. This has been a decades-long project from people like the Koch brothers and people predating the Koch brothers, like, you know, Ronald Reagan and others, who understood in order to break the Democratic Party's ties to organized labor, you really had to weaken labor unions themselves. And once labor unions were weakened, they no longer could offer the same protections, the same benefits they did before. So a voter who 25 years ago would have automatically been a Democrat because they were part of an auto workers union or another type of union, now is a free agent politically in some sense because there is no union to look out for them. The union has been broken. It's been weakened. You've seen states like Ohio and Wisconsin systematically attack unions with right to work laws. And it's no coincidence in my mind that the Democratic Party has weakened in those states in tandem with the decline of organized labor. These things have gone together. Certainly in Michigan, too, though Biden won Michigan, the Democratic Party has weakened in Michigan as well. So the movement away from organized labor, which is both a decision the Democratic Party made, but also a trend undertaken by the Republican Party, has certainly decreased the ability of Democrats to chase working class voters without college degrees. This is a trend that spans demographics, and this is always the thing that's lost on the liberal left, where if you bring up economic issues, they'll wave the hand and go, oh, that's an identity issue. They're all white supremacists. They make fun of the idea of economic grievance. Well, the 2020 election, in my mind, put that to rest. You saw Donald Trump make tremendous gains with voters of color. I mean, this is inarguable. Latino and Spanish-speaking voters in particular, and this was widespread. This was in Texas. This was in New York. This was in Pennsylvania. This was in California. You pick a locality. Donald Trump is growing his vote with Spanish-speaking voters, and he's growing his vote with black voters as well. Donald Trump gained support in New York City. I'm in New York City right now. Donald Trump did better in 2020 in New York City than he did in 2016. Every big diverse city, I would have to go through each of them, but most, if not all, saw gains by the Republican Party and by Donald Trump. You can't even say it's the Republican Party because they're so synonymous. Donald Trump is the Republican Party. He still is the Republican Party. And this is something the left has to remember. There is no post-Trump Republican Party, not until he dies or something happened. It's his party. So you see these gains happening with working class voters of color. I think generally speaking, working class voters without college educations, both white and non-white, share a lot of values. They have similar values. And the Democratic Party is becoming a party of educated elites. It is becoming a condescending party that is obsessed with college education and obsessed with the values that come with college education at the expense of those without. 60% of the country still does not have a college degree, and that's a fact we should all remember. And you are not going to win without voters without college degrees unless you manage to somehow flip that percentage, or that percentage isn't going to flip anytime soon. And it's worth remembering voters with college degrees once represented a very small portion of America and certainly of the Democratic Party. So they were not a big constituency. Now they are. And certainly for the Democratic Party, there have been benefits of embracing the college-educated, wealthy voter. We should add affluent voter. You've seen Democrats make gains in the suburbs. Are they sustainable? That's a big question. I don't know the answer to that. But what's fascinating in how American politics has changed is that it used to be that class was a predictor of your politics, but it was in reverse. The wealthy voter, let's say in 1990, was more likely to be a Republican. The poorer voter is more likely to be a Democrat. Now that ratio has been flipped. As your income and education level rises, you trend toward the Democratic Party now. As your education income falls, you trend toward the Republican Party. The Democrats, in order to build a sustainable movement that wins the Senate, wins the White House continually, or at least forestalls Republican gains, will have to figure out a way to pull more working class voters without college degrees of all races into their coalition, because the Senate is designed in such a way right now where it's very unfavorable to the Democratic Party. You have many small rural states that are increasingly voting Republican, and you have a lot of Democratic voters packed into large cities and suburbs, and that makes their vote distribution a lot less efficient. So this is a long-term challenge for the Democratic Party that it has to resolve in some way to maintain the power that it has.
Do they have to go ahead and proclaim their support for labor unions? Do they how do they start to bring those voters back into the fold?
There needs to be a concerted effort to revive organized labor. It's not enough to proclaim support. I think verbally any Democrat is now pro-labor. You wouldn't probably find a Democrat who disparages labor unions. Joe Manchin is pro-labor. But West Virginia is like a great microcosm of this. I mean, there was a time when West Virginia was one of the most Democratic states in America, where the Democratic Party was dominant in West Virginia, and they were very closely tied to the mine workers unions and organized labor there. Of course, we know the story of the decline of coal, the decline of unions there, and now that state is strongly Republican. So I do think it starts with figuring out some way to revive organized labor, to change laws in these states to make them friendlier to unions. Some of these states are incredibly hostile to unions, incredibly hostile, including states that have voted Democrat in presidential elections, like Wisconsin and Ohio. If you cannot make Wisconsin and Ohio more hospitable to organized labor, you're going to have a very hard time winning there. And Republicans know this. Republicans are very smart. I think the Republican elite is generally a lot smarter and has a lot more foresight and is a lot more cutthroat than the Democratic elite. And I felt this way for a while. They get it. They understand what politics is. It's a zero-sum game. There are winners and losers. You must crush the other side or you're not winning. And Democrats don't get this. I think they're starting to. So this is a long-term project, but I do believe it begins with organized labor. I do believe it is focusing, you know, strongly on economic issues, which is something you're seeing more of. I was gratified to see how the Warnock and Ossoff campaigns in Georgia really honed in on the stimulus checks. That was so essential to their campaign pitches, and they were very disciplined and they won. And I think that the Warnock-Ossoff approach, you know, really drilling down on these economic issues that affect everyone, is very, very important. Bernie Sanders got this in his 2016 campaign. I think he got a bit away from it in the 2020 campaign. And I personally support canceling student debt. I think we should do $50,000. I think it would be great for a lot of people. This is where I do understand Joe Biden's position, because there are people, a lot of working class and poor people, who never went to college. And so for them, they see debt cancellation. They go, why aren't you canceling my medical debt? Right. Why aren't you canceling my mortgage? Right? So we should pursue debt cancellation. I support it fully. I get where some in politics like Biden and some on the left are a little skeptical of it, in that you have to think about how this issue will resonate with the people who don't have college degrees and never went to college, and maybe they dropped out of high school and they look at a friend who went to a private school and gets their debt canceled, and they go, well, I'm sitting here with medical debt. I've got car bills. I've got bills on my house. Where's my bailout, right? So we have to be thinking in those terms. I really think the Democratic Party, like it did under FDR, needs to be thinking of these mass scale economic programs that are going to make a difference in the lives of like many millions of people. I think, you know, UBI is an interesting idea. Bernie was right to focus on healthcare. We need to get people healthcare. We need to get them money. We need to get them jobs. Whether it's a jobs guarantee, I saw Ayanna Pressley recently introduced a jobs guarantee bill. I think that's something that people like AOC and Pressley should really emphasize a lot more. If I had a criticism of AOC, I think she has a lot of really good policy and legislation. I think she doesn't always talk about it enough. I think there, you know, like there are a lot of bills that benefit a lot of people that aren't necessarily associated with this kind of new and vocal left, right? Medicare for All is very much associated with Bernie. I think we need to have something like a jobs guarantee associated fully with AOC and with Pressley and with Omar and with the new the new left. We need that to happen. People, voters have to be thinking, oh, the Democratic Party, that's the party that wants to give me a job and give me money. And right now, it's very muddled. And Republicans are really good at playing off cultural grievance. They are very good at using cultural issues as a distraction. So, you know, when, you know, people on the left roll their eyes when Republicans scream about cancel culture or, you know, about attacks on religious liberty, these things in the absence of economic issues, all this stuff resonates. So if you don't have salient economic issues to combat culture, culture will win. And that's something Democrats have to realize, that you need to fill the void. Republicans are great at filling the void. They fill the void with crap 24/7. Donald Trump did it 24/7. And Democrats need to be there really talking about these issues. I think it really begins with universal health care, a universal basic income, a right to a job. Anyone who wants a job should be able to get one and live in economic dignity. It really starts there. And if you're able to implement these policies, talk about these policies, you build an enduring majority, and that's what Franklin Roosevelt did. You had a 30-year period where the Democratic Party dominated American politics, and the Republican Party was a very liberal party by modern standards that had to embrace the New Deal agenda. Dwight Eisenhower, by our modern definition, was a Democratic president. He was a center-center-left president because he governed in FDR's shadow. Richard Nixon was a center-to-center-left president. He implemented the EPA. He was someone who also governed in the shadow of the New Deal. And then after that period, the end of expanding the social safety net. And we need to get back to that. We have to get back.
So one of the biggest things that I think stands in the way of us getting big programs like that passed, and this gets back to your point about, you know, shedding daylight on both parties, really, is the influence of money in politics. I mean, you covered the fact that big tech spent $200 million to make sure that that they got their way with the ballot measure in California that had to do with gig workers. Do you see any type of repeal or any change to Citizens United and all of the big money, the dark money in politics? Because I really, to be honest, don't see us getting to a Medicare for All or a UBI or some of these larger programs without, you know, reducing the influence that corporations and the ultra rich have over our lawmaking process.
I don't see a repeal of Citizens United with the Supreme Court. It's you have a very conservative court now. It seems highly unlikely. I think the one bright spot is the left has gotten a lot better at raising money and raising money online. In the instance of California, yes, the tech industry far outspent their opponents, and there's no doubt in situations like that the left is on the defensive and is outgunned. The good news is you have candidates like Bernie Sanders, like AOC, even Joe Biden, once he was a nominee, who were able to raise tons of money with small donations online. So I do think online fundraising is as much as a counterweight as that exists. At the same time, the dark money is going to stay, and the influence of that is going to stay. So the left is going to have to figure out how do we do this. I think ironically, you know, a UBI or a jobs guarantee is probably more feasible than single payer healthcare. And I say that because there are very few interest groups that are organized against the idea of giving money to people. Like, right, there's no counter lobby to, hey, let's give money to people. There are Republicans who would scream about the deficit. There are Democrats who would say, we're not going to spend that money. Same thing with the jobs guarantee. But there's not a anti-jobs coalition that is going to come down and say, no, we do not want this. We cannot make this happen. Right. Tragically, with healthcare, there's the medical lobby, the health insurance lobby is an extremely powerful force, and Bernie Sanders is willing to confront it. We'll need another politician willing to do that. That's what we'll need, because it will be the most titanic of political fights. If you are going to move toward a version of single payer, even a public option, this is a existential threat to private insurance. And the private insurance industry knows this. It's why they torpedoed the public option with Obamacare. A public option would have made Obamacare much more palatable. Without a public option, Obamacare really is a mediocre healthcare system for those who have to deal with it. I find most people who support Obamacare don't have to actually use Obamacare. It is expensive. It is unwieldy. It's good if you can get Medicaid and you qualify, it's fine. I think it was good for that. But just give everyone Medicaid. Medicaid is much easier to use than going on an exchange and bartering for health insurance. It's very unwieldy. So pursuing healthcare reform in this country and getting to single payer, getting to even a public option is a major, major fight because you have an entire industry that is ready to mobilize against it and has been mobilizing for decades. And we know since Harry Truman, we've been talking about universal health care in this country. Britain did it after World War II. We should have done it then. And now here we are stuck all these years later. So I want to be optimistic about the healthcare fight. I'm not currently because it is such a huge fight. I do think just as we've seen with the success of the stimulus checks, there is much more of an appetite for big government spending to help people. So I am more optimistic there in the interim. Even Mitt Romney's plan to give $3,000, I think, for everyone with a child. I mean, this is something that could come out of Sweden, you know, or come out of a pretty left-wing politician who would have been laughed off the map a few years ago. That is a big change in politics, and that's where I am optimistic that the lever has definitely moved to the left on economic issues. It's very easy to forget this in the day-to-day fights online, in kind of the headlines in the news, with the general despair that comes with being involved in politics and working in it or covering it or writing about it, talking about it. But I do see hope, and so I do think even with Citizens United and with all these obstacles, big things can come out of the federal government.
I was interested to read your critique of Chuck Schumer and his leadership in your November article in Jacobin. You mentioned he does a great job of raising money, but you kind of laid out some of the problems you see with him as Senate Majority Leader. I think at the time, you know, it was looking more and more like he'd be Senate Minority Leader, but why do you think Democrats should look elsewhere for Senate leadership?
Yeah, I will add as a caveat, so far Schumer has been responsive to the left. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's worried about a primary challenge next year. So he's certainly someone who has moved much more to the left than he ever was before. That being said, I don't think he has the internal savvy and the ability to be cutthroat that it really comes with being a strong legislative leader to achieve your policy aims. I really believe that the Democratic Party must find their version of Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell has been relentless in stopping the Democratic agenda and fighting for his agenda, which was conservative judges. And he was wildly successful at this. And the Democratic Party, under Harry Reid, I do think Reid had more of the fight in him. They need to eventually find leadership who is both charismatic and able to communicate the Democratic agenda to people, but also really willing to fight to the political death to achieve policy aim. And Chuck Schumer is not that politician. He never will be. The best thing I can say for Chuck Schumer is he is a weather vane like Joe Biden is. And when you're a weather vane, that does mean you're reactive to both good and bad. And in this case, you do have a Democratic Party trending left. So Chuck Schumer is out there on the front lines on some important fights like canceling student debt. Will Schumer do what it takes to actually get these things done? That's the open question, right? He's been saying a lot of nice things of late. He's been talking a good game, but he needs to be able to deliver. Will he deliver? What will this budget reconciliation process look like? How much local aid will be sent to states like New York that desperately need it? That is an open question, and we'll see what he does.
So we've spoken a few times of AOC. I would say that we've kind of seen a pattern emerge of late of Democratic Socialists, some are even registered DSA members, getting elected to Congress. First, we had the Squad, and in the most recent election, we had Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush winning seats in Congress. Do you see this pattern continuing? Do you see it accelerating? And at what point do you think we'll have enough members of Congress who subscribe to a more Democratic Socialist approach where they actually have significant bargaining power in Congress?
I see the trend continuing. I'm optimistic. The Republican Party did this with the Tea Party. The conservatives in the party were able to very effectively replace the moderates and push the party in a much more conservative direction for a long period of time. And you are seeing the Democrats slowly begin to tug their party to the left on economic and social issues. And I have no reason to not believe there are going to be more Jamal Bowmans, Cori Bushes, and AOCs. There are a lot of Democrats out there who can be primaried. There are going to be open primaries. What's the number to have leverage? That's a good question. I don't have an exact answer for you. What I would say is the bigger the better. You know, if you can build a block of 10, of 20, of 30, you become a force. And it's just going to come with every election cycle.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. If folks enjoyed hearing what you had to say and they want to seek out some of the writing that you've done, where can they find that?
So if they're interested in local New York politics, I'm writing about the mayor's race for the Village Voice, which just came back from the dead, which is very exciting.
That is exciting.
You can find me also on local issues in Gothamist. I write on national politics for The Guardian, and then I'll appear sporadically in other places as well, like the Daily Beast. I was in the New York Times in January. You know, they can follow me on Twitter too, at Ross Barkin. And actually, I haven't told many people at all. I'm keeping this kind of quiet, but by the time we publish, you can mention it. I am writing a book on Andrew Cuomo that will be published fairly soon by Or Books, but I haven't announced that yet. But that is upcoming, so should be exciting when it comes out.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I'll be looking for that book as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So what'd you guys think of Ross Barkin?
Yeah, he brings a really interesting perspective. I like how he brought it back to Bill Clinton and sort of brought us to the present moment and where we are. It stood out to me. I don't know how I feel about this comment when he said the Democratic Party is becoming the party of educated elites. I mean, it certainly has educated elites, no doubt about it. But I guess I wonder if that's the driving force. Like, in other words, did educated elites take back the Georgia, like the Senate via the Georgia, the seats in the special election, or did they, you know, get us to 81 million votes, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I think he's talking more about the perception and the fact that we've had kind of an exodus of blue collar, non-college educated voters. But I thought it was interesting that he said that that's a pattern worldwide, that working class voters across the world are leaving the center left parties. I mean, I think he makes a great point about trying to steer clear of identity politics in favor of a strong economic message in order to get those types of voters interested again and make it clear that we have those voters' backs. I mean, he actually mentioned the fact that he thinks Warnoff and Ossoff were really disciplined candidates in that they stuck to that economic message of, you know, you vote for us in $2,000 checks, which are apparently $1,400 now, will go out immediately, which apparently means March 14th. C-Money, what did you think of the interview?
I thought he had some really interesting, informed perspective on stuff. I found myself agreeing with probably about 90% of what he was saying, you know, just kind of making show notes. I thought I was like just typing a lot of his phrases out and nodding my head. I do think there's special significance to him pointing out, like, focusing on class and not culture, because that's kind of how the right sort of hoodwinks the working class. And it's kind of put a lot of those machinations in place that have led the Republican Party to start saying it's the real party of the working class. And, you know, like Ted Cruz with his mullet and his store-bought cowboy gear, you know, saying, "We're the Blue Jean Party now," and like Tom Cotton saying that. I feel like it's part of a bigger pattern, and I think it also plays into the other stuff he was talking about the Democratic Party becoming the party of elites, of educated elites.
Well, and he made a great point there in that, you know, we're talking about debt cancellation and we're only hitting a small segment of the population if we're only canceling student debt. And that plays right into the idea of, you know, the Democrats only being a party of the educated elite. We really should have a conversation about canceling other types of debt, especially debt like credit cards, which can just bury a family eventually.
Medical debt.
Right, exactly. But I do think Barkin provided us with a lot of perspective that I think gets lost in the day-to-day, and especially like with the people with whom I interact on Twitter, who tend to really gun for Democrats.
Are you saying Twitter's not real life?
They kind of gun for Democrats the second that it seems like Democrats are kind of giving up whatever cause they hope that they would take up. But I think one point that Barkin made that I have read in a lot of other places, and I've heard as criticism quite a bit about Democrats, is that the idea that Republicans get it, it's a zero-sum game. You know, there are winners and losers. This is a quote directly from him, and you must crush the other side if you're not winning. And Democrats don't get this. He said he thinks they're starting to, but like they really don't get the fact that you both can't win. We've already heard Democrats saying, you know, left and right, that the country is better when there's a strong Republican Party. You never hear Republicans say that about Democrats. They just don't acknowledge like the value in Democrats, and that helps them kind of win that zero-sum game. Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message. That's 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.